this is going to be the hardest and the saddest week of most Americans' lives, quite frankly. This is going to be our Pearl Harbor moment, our 9/11 moment, only it's not going to be localized. It's going to be happening all over the country. And I want America to understand that. But I also want them to understand that the public, along with the state and the federal government, have the power to change the trajectory of this epidemic.
Surgeon General Jerome Adams on Fox News Sunday. His grave projection was echoed by Dr. Anthony Fauci, the government's top infectious disease expert. So what does that mean for California and for LA County? It's still unclear how many people in California have been infected, mainly because testing is so poor. Governor Gavin Newsom said as much this weekend.
Let me just acknowledge on the outset that the testing space has been a challenging one for us, and I own that. And I have a responsibility as your governor to do better and to do more testing in the state of California.
Well, aside from testing, how well prepared are we for the expected onslaught? Joining us to talk about this is LA Times health reporter Soumya Karlamangla. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. All right. So in LA County, there were more deaths over the weekend. How many and what is the trajectory looking like now?
Yeah, Saturday was an unusually high number of deaths. We'd seen around 10 every day for the past week or so. And on Saturday, there were 28 reported in a single day. So with and then about 15 on Sunday. So that brought the total in LA County to 130. It's hard to tell. I mean, the trajectory of this disease is really long. And so with the deaths, we often are seeing people who got infected before the social distancing measures. And I think that we expect to see the death numbers continue to climb, but are hopeful that at some point we'll see the case numbers start to level off because the social distancing should eventually mean that fewer people are getting infected.
So let's talk about the testing, because as we just heard, very few people have been tested in California. Newsom is promising a big ramp up of testing. When do we expect that to happen?
I mean, he says that it's happening, I think, imminently, but the testing has been really bad. I mean, the testing has been a nationwide problem, but in California, it's been particularly bad. Like, I was just reviewing the numbers, and in New York, they've tested 302,000 people. In California, we've tested 130, and California is twice the size of New York. So, like, every time they make one of these promises, we look at them kind of skeptically because the numbers in California have just never caught up to what they have promised and what other states have managed to pull off.
Why has California fallen behind, so far behind in testing?
Honestly, it's a little baffling even to me. It seems like they've listed every problem in the book. Like, they didn't have enough of the reagent to run the test. They didn't have enough labs. They didn't have enough swabs. I mean, the best way to put it is that it's just become a very disorganized process. And I hope that, you know, Newsom can take charge and increase the testing numbers because we really need that.
Well, meanwhile, he's touting this Stanford test that could test for antibodies. So for people who are supposedly immune to COVID-19, what's the story with that?
I actually don't know that much about the Stanford test, but there are a lot of different efforts to try to test for antibodies. And it's really important that we eventually get that, because at some point we will want to go back to our normal lives and we'll still be waiting for a vaccine or a treatment, but people will need to go back to work, and it'll be really useful to know who is immune to the disease, because those people can kind of, you know, get to work restarting the economy. Or for healthcare workers, like, which ones can actually be working on the COVID ward. So the antibody tests will be crucial to the kind of long-term response to this outbreak.
Right. Well, in the meantime, what about being able to combat this outbreak as it happens? Do we have enough ventilators? Do we have enough beds? Do we have enough PPE right now?
Yeah. In California, it's just hard to say because we don't know how big the surge is going to be. I mean, we're definitely nowhere near what they're seeing in New York. And I think everyone's fingers are crossed that we're not going to get there. But, you know, over the weekend, we saw that big increase in deaths. We're seeing big increases in hospitalizations. And again, those deaths, just because of how long it takes for people to, from the point they are infected to the point they end up in the hospital, can be multiple weeks. And so we might still be seeing the effects of people who got sick before the social distancing. So it's really hard to know. I mean, we've really stocked up on ventilators. They've cleared out a ton of hospital beds. Like, in LA County on Friday, they said that they had 1,600 empty hospital beds because they had cleared out so many, you know, elective surgeries, and the COVID surge just hadn't hit in that huge way yet.
And again, we don't really know exactly when that surge is going to hit.
No, because it depends on so many different factors, right? And largely on the social distancing and when we'll see the effects of that. And I think a lot of projections have put it sometime in late April, mid-April, but we just really don't know. Like, if the social distancing were lifted tomorrow, the surge could hit, you know, in 3 days.
Which it won't be, because our public officials are pretty adamant about keeping that in place.
Yeah.
What about neighboring counties like Orange and Riverside? How are they doing?
So Riverside seems to be a little strapped for space. I think they have fewer hospitals, and they were kind of sounding the alarm earlier this week that things had gotten bad there. They also instated a requirement that everyone wear a mask, just like LA did, but theirs is a much more, I think it's like was approved so that it's actually like a law. It's not just a recommendation. So they seem to be really worried about what's going to happen. I mean, or same with Orange County, their case numbers are climbing, but no one compares to LA. LA has, you know, I think the second highest county in California has 1,000-something cases, and LA County has 5,000. And so LA County really is emerging as the hotspot with the highest concentration of cases.
Well, Soumya, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
That's LA Times health reporter Soumya Karlamangla. Well, President Trump again recommended an anti-malaria drug to treat coronavirus this weekend.
And the other thing that we've bought a tremendous amount of is the hydroxychloroquine, which I think, as you know, it's a great malaria drug. It's worked unbelievably. It's a powerful drug on malaria. And there are signs that it works on this, some very strong signs.
But there's only limited anecdotal evidence it works on coronavirus. Here is the government's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, on CBS yesterday.
You know, as I've said many times, Margaret, the data are really just at best suggestive. There have been cases that show there may be an effect, and there are others to show there's no effect.
Okay.
So I think in terms of science, I don't think we could definitively say it works.
All right. Well, here to tell us more about this drug is Katie Thomas. She covers healthcare and the drug industry for the New York Times. Hi.
Hi.
All right. So this drug, hydroxychloroquine, tell us about it. And we just heard the president say that it's used to treat malaria and lupus. Tell us how it works for those diseases.
It's a pretty old drug. There's another related one called chloroquine, and it's been used for a long time to treat malaria. It also has approval for, as you mentioned, lupus and also rheumatoid arthritis.
And is it pretty effective treating those diseases?
Yes. My understanding is, especially for lupus, it is. In rheumatoid arthritis, there are many people that depend on it. There are many different drugs for rheumatoid arthritis, but it's one that is still used by a lot of people. And for lupus, it's seen as a very valuable drug and can be life-threatening if people with lupus don't have it.
All right. So Trump said yesterday the government has ordered 29 million pills of this and thinking that it will work to treat coronavirus. What is the evidence that it could actually work on coronavirus?
There's not a whole lot of evidence yet. There's been a couple of studies, some in China. There's one that's much discussed in France. And then there was just a study that came out early last week that looked at it as well. And that one was also from China. The one that's from France that has generated a lot of discussion has come under some pretty significant criticism from scientists and researchers, as has some of the other Chinese ones, because they don't have a control. They don't have a placebo group. And they're small. Dr. Fauci, as I think you heard, has described this evidence as anecdotal. The more recent one that came out did have a control, but also was very small, and people said also had limitations. It's hard to really draw, you know, a really good conclusion about whether this is going to work or not.
Well, in New York State, they're giving doctors permission to use it with azithromycin, the so-called Z-Pak. Why are they doing that if there's no real scientific evidence that it works yet?
I think there are a lot of doctors and in hospitals that share kind of a kernel of what President Trump is talking about. They say, look, this is a drug. It's been around for decades. It has side effects, but we as a medical community are pretty familiar with this drug and we're familiar with its risks. And when we are facing a brand new disease where there are people who are dying from this disease, you know, let's try it. Sure. You know, especially with few other options, it's a pretty widely available drug. Let's give it to them in the hopes that it will help.
Right. And here is the president echoing that sentiment.
I just think it's something, you know, the expression, I've used it for certain reasons. What do you have to lose? What do you have to lose? And a lot of people are saying that when and are taking it, if you're a doctor, a nurse, a first responder, a medical person going into hospitals, they say taking it before the fact is good. But what do you have to lose? They say take it.
So what do you have to lose? Aren't there serious side effects?
There are. And, you know, the most serious one is something that can cause basically a heart arrhythmia and can lead to sudden cardiac arrest in some patients. And the thing is that people who have a severe reaction to the coronavirus also may be the very same people who could be at a higher risk to have this sort of reaction to the drug. Hydroxychloroquine, like many drugs, also can interact poorly with other medications. So again, if you have a sick person who had other underlying health conditions and perhaps is taking other drugs, that's also a risk. And, you know, as some have pointed out to me as well, even though, you know, there's this risk for this heart arrhythmia for people who already have known heart problems, it can also pop up in people who, you know, who thought that they had a normal heart. So it is rare, but it's very dangerous. It's deadly. And, you know, as this one doctor I was speaking to last night said, you want to be careful because you could also cause a more serious medical complication by giving this drug to coronavirus patients. And then you've got another layer, basically, of care that doctors have to scramble and figure out how to treat this patient.
Well, Katie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Katie Thomas, she covers healthcare and the drug industry for the New York Times. Coming up, Wisconsin suspends its primary and Texas suspends abortions. What authority do governors have to take these actions? The Legal Eagle, Jessica Levinson, is here next on Press Play.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Wisconsin's presidential primary is back on for tomorrow. Earlier today, it was off. The governor had postponed it till June. But hours later, the state Supreme Court overruled him. And that ruling caps about a week of back and forth between Governor Tony Evers, a Democrat, and Republicans in the state legislature there. They're also fighting over absentee ballots. Jessica Levinson is here to talk about this. She is our regular legal and a professor, a law professor at Loyola Law School. Hi.
Hi there.
Okay, can you please set us straight here because my neck hurts from going back and forth. First, the election was off. Now it's on. What happened?
Paging a chiropractor here. So I'm not sure I can really set us straight because there's been so much up and back. But essentially what's going on is the Democratic governor of Wisconsin said on Friday to the Republican-controlled legislature, we can't go forward with an in-person election. This is lunacy. We shouldn't have people choosing between their safety and their ability to weigh in on the election. So he's pushed basically two things. One is he said, we have to push back the date of the election. Other states have done it during this primary season. We have the power to do it. There's really no good reason why we shouldn't do it. He's also said, let's extend absentee voting so that the people who have pending applications can get their votes. People have a little bit more time to turn in their votes. And we know, at least based on postponing the date of the election, which was before, as you said, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, that what the court said is, Governor, you don't have the power under Wisconsin state law to do that on your own. You need the legislature to join you, and the legislature refuses to do so.
So is that it? Is that the end of the story? It's going to go forward tomorrow?
It's kind of the end of the story. So yes, I think there will be in-person voting tomorrow. The reporting I've seen is that 5 of 180 polling places will actually be open, that poll workers have said, I don't feel comfortable going to work. I feel like it's a serious threat to my health and safety. That there are, in fact, some counties that have been closed. So those counties will now have to be forced to be open. So there may actually be some additional legal challenge on that front. And then, of course, there's still the question of whether or not there can be a delay in accepting the absentee ballots. So yes, to your question, it does look like there will be in-person voting in Wisconsin tomorrow. It also looks like there's a lot of other unanswered questions.
Well, one of them I have, and that is, if there are only 5 of 180 polling places open, how is that then not the basis for a future lawsuit saying that every vote that was possible was not counted, that lots of voters were disenfranchised?
So yes, I think that there is every possibility that there could be a federal lawsuit in this case. And so under the federal constitution, you still have to have elections that pass a certain threshold to know that those elections have integrity. Now, the constitution does give states the power to set the time, place, and manner of elections. But again, you still have to give people a meaningful opportunity to weigh in. It's not at all clear at this point that Wisconsin, with so many polling places closed, with people feeling like they have to make a decision between their health and their ability to exercise their right to vote, that they really are holding a meaningful election.
Well, what is the Republican position here? What are their arguments for holding the election tomorrow?
Yeah, so there are legal arguments, and then I think there are the real arguments, which are the political arguments. The legal arguments they're making is that there will be vacancies because there are state and local officials that are on the ballot, and they're saying we can't let those positions stay open for so long. Now, the governor tried to actually solve that in his executive order by saying, well, let's just extend their terms. That wasn't a successful solution. The Republicans have also said when you move to vote by mail, then it means that there's an increased fear of fraud, that it actually threatens the integrity of the election. It will say all facts to the contrary. So the idea that we would be more worried about, frankly, virtually non-existent voter fraud when it comes to vote by mail as compared to very real and significant voter suppression and chilling of the ability of voters to weigh in, really isn't a question in this case. So I think what's really going on is that Republicans know and are starting to openly acknowledge lower turnout elections are better for Republicans and worse for Democrats. So this is really raw political partisanship, and they're using the legal system to try and accomplish this political goal.
All right, let's turn to another story in the news right now related to this coronavirus pandemic, and that is at least 6 conservative states have tried to restrict access to abortion right now, and most of those efforts have been overturned by courts. However, not in Texas, where the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals allowed a law to go into effect on a temporary basis. So I understand that a lot of states are halting elective surgeries. This doesn't seem particularly elective since there is a time constraint. So what are the arguments there?
Yeah, I would say it doesn't seem particularly elective. And I believe that the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists have said it's not elective. And so I think what's happening here is actually very similar to what was happening with respect to Wisconsin and when they'll hold their election, which is there are legal arguments which are basically that we need to keep our hospitals as low as possible in terms of capacity, that we need to try and delay everything that's potentially possible to delay. But then there are the political arguments, which is that these are temporary prohibitions put in place by states very eager to restrict a woman's right to obtain an abortion. And I think that the politics is really what this is about here. What the federal courts have said is, you know, with respect to the Supreme Court standard from Casey versus Planned Parenthood, there's no exception to that standard for a global pandemic. There's no exception for states saying we want to basically shut down almost all or all abortions, even temporarily. And so the Fifth Circuit in this case is really an outlier, allowing that temporary ban to go forward.
And do you think the Supreme Court, if and when it reconvenes in the near future or the not so near future, will take this up?
Yeah, I think that the Supreme Court is, it's going to be very difficult for them to avoid this, again, if the prohibition really does go into place for any appreciable amount of time, particularly because we're talking about the federal right to obtain access to an abortion. And we're talking about the Fifth Circuit that, frankly, I think has gone against Supreme Court precedent. And really, the only way to solve that is for the Supreme Court to step in.
All right, Jessica, always great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jessica Levinson teaches law at Loyola Law School. She's our regular Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Thanks, Jessica.
Thank you.
Well, speaking of abortion, a new movie about a girl who travels from her small town in Pennsylvania to New York to get an abortion is now available on demand. The title of the movie, Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always, is taken from a questionnaire the girl takes at the clinic.
That test is actually on the intake form at Planned Parenthood, and it's really meant as a way to open up a conversation to, you know, see if there are other ways in which Planned Parenthood can help somebody.
The director, Eliza Hittman, is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Now, a new movie you can watch at home. It's called Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always. It was supposed to be released in theaters last month, and back then it was pretty timely, given the news in the Supreme Court. It's about what happens when a 17-year-old named Autumn finds out she's pregnant. She lives in a small Pennsylvania town, and she goes to a storefront clinic to get help. And here's what they tell her.
This is your beautiful baby. You are about 10 weeks along. Hard to say precisely, but everything looks pretty normal. And this is the most magical sound you will ever hear.
Well, she doesn't think that's magical at all. She wants an abortion, but she's at a crisis pregnancy center run by an anti-abortion group. And so Autumn scrapes together some money, gets on a Greyhound bus bound for New York, where she can end her pregnancy. Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always is directed by Eliza Hittman. I spoke with her a few weeks ago when her movie was supposed to open in theaters and the Supreme Court was hearing an abortion case out of Louisiana. Well, your movie is coming out just as the Supreme Court is hearing an abortion case out of Louisiana. So the timing is pretty good in terms of relevance to real life. But you started writing this years ago, right?
Yeah, I started writing this film in 2012, actually. I was just reading a newspaper and I read about the death of Savita Halappanavar in Ireland, who had died, you know, after being denied a life-saving abortion. And I just started educating myself about, you know, the history of abortion in Ireland. And I got a book called Ireland's Hidden Diaspora. And I read about how women would travel from Ireland across the Irish Sea and back in one day. They'd go to London for an abortion. And there was something about that journey that really intrigued me. And I started thinking about what the U.S. equivalent of that journey looks like.
interesting because a lot of women do face that same kind of journey in the United States, all over the place. I mean, I think 10 million women live at least an hour's journey away from a place where they can get an abortion.
Yeah, I was just thinking about, you know, how we never see stories about the barriers that women encounter. And, you know, I wanted to explore a narrative, you know, that showed how hard it is just to get a legal abortion in America.
Right. Well, because abortion is technically still legal in America, but for many people, it's out of reach.
Yeah.
So Autumn is in this small Pennsylvania town. And she, you can tell from the opening scene that she's pretty troubled. She comes from a difficult family. And she is in this working class town. She doesn't have a lot of money. And she is kind of an outcast, I guess. Is that a good way of describing her in school? Mm-hmm. She's not one of the popular girls.
I would call her, you know, a 17-year-old who has kind of a quiet rage underneath the surface. And she is isolated from her family, and she is very alone and alone with her body.
Yeah, there's a really powerful scene where she comes back from the crisis pregnancy center and you know, really wants to end the pregnancy herself and tries to do so. She punches herself in the stomach. It's really moving. How did you do research for this in terms of how women and girls in these parts of the country and places that aren't in metropolitan areas handle being pregnant?
I did a lot of field work on the film. I got into a car and I went into rural Pennsylvania, and I was really drawn to this coal mining region. And I sort of picked a town where I really felt the story should begin. And I asked myself, if I was this 17-year-old girl, you know, what would I do and who would I turn to for help? So I went into some local pregnancy centers and I took a test and I sat with women, you know, who counsel at these centers and had very similar conversations. So I tried to, you know, write from my own firsthand experiences as much as possible rather than, you know, writing from a stereotype or caricature that I might have in my head about who they are and what they do. So there's a lot of things that are in the script of the film that are a reflection of conversations that I had.
So you took a pregnancy test at one of these centers?
I did, and I was given a little gold gift bag with pamphlets about the rights and responsibilities of the father and adoption information.
Were you pregnant?
I wasn't, but they give them anyway.
Wow. What did you learn about the pregnancy centers that you didn't know before?
They're, you know, run by layman women. They have equipment inside them that are not, you know, current. They, you know, have in their minds, well-intentioned, but, you know, they are not licensed facilities. They're mostly filled with donations, to be honest. And I think that's their way in which they think they can reach and help women.
Right. So Autumn, when she takes a pregnancy test there, it's just a test that you could buy at the supermarket.
Yeah, correct.
And she realizes that and she's kind of incredulous.
Yeah. And then you learn that she works at a supermarket.
Right.
So that's what's sort of comic about it.
Yeah. But then they show her this movie, which is a pretty graphic movie called The Hard Truth. Is that what happened when you went to one of these centers?
No, they had other materials. I chose that one because the rights for it were free.
Oh, I see.
Yes. But they do show materials like that.
I want to play a clip from the abortion clinic in New York where Autumn is with a counselor right before she gets her procedure. And the counselor is asking her goes through a whole list, a questionnaire about her relationships.
Your partner's threatened or frightened you? Never? Rarely? Sometimes? Always?
Why are you asking me this?
I want to make sure that you're safe. Your partners threatened or frightened you? Never? Rarely? Sometimes? Always?
Rarely?
Okay.
Never, rarely, sometimes, always, the title of your film. And is that a scene, that scene, is that something that does play out in those words at abortion clinics?
It is. I, you know, spent a lot of time in New York and in Pennsylvania meeting with Planned Parenthood and talking to clinicians and social workers, and also went to a few, you know, private clinics like Choices in Queens, and just really tried to put myself in the position of the character and ask them a lot of questions like, you know, what would your concerns be if a minor came into the office, and, you know, how would you deal with someone coming in from out of state? And, you know, obviously a big concern is safety and understanding, you know, the circumstances around, you know, someone's pregnancy. And that test is actually on the intake form at Planned Parenthood. And it's really meant as a way to open up a conversation to, you know, see if there are other ways in which Planned Parenthood can help somebody.
You really get a window into Autumn. I mean, you never find out conclusively in the movie how she got pregnant, but you can infer a lot from that scene. It's really a powerful scene. And
I can also say, Madeline, the woman who Sydney Flanagan, the actress, is acting with is actually a social worker who I met in my research process named Kelly Chapman. So part of what makes the film, I think, so effective is, you know, her understanding and creating, you know, a really safe space for Sydney, you know, who's a first-time actor.
So it was that really hard for Sydney to play that scene?
I think there was a lot of pressure building up to it, obviously, and it was a scene we saved for later into the shoot. Mm-hmm. But when it was done, she thought it was incredibly cathartic, and she also said she knew she couldn't do a second take. So she nailed it on the first one and made herself incredibly vulnerable in it.
So how did you find this actress who plays Autumn?
I met her at 14, actually, in 2013. She was a kid in South Buffalo, where my partner is from, and we were working on a movie that I was producing at the time, and she was just kind of on the periphery of this other film shoot, kind of hanging out and dating somebody that was in the movie. And we met her in passing and just added her on Facebook, and over the years, you know, we sort of watched her grow up, and she's an aspiring musician, and she posted a lot of DIY videos of her playing guitar in her bedroom alone, and they captured something, you know, beautifully authentic about being a teenager, and they're very rough and raw and filled with pain and hope. And she sort of filtered her way, you know, into my mind as I was writing the script. And I thought about her from the beginning, but I didn't know she would want to do a movie, you know, and she didn't know me. And when we started auditioning the film, I looked at a lot of actresses and a lot of non-actors that we had found doing non-traditional search all over Pennsylvania. And I just kept thinking about Sydney. So I twisted her arm over Facebook, and she flew to New York and put trust in me and eventually said yes. But I don't think she ever, you know, thought of herself acting.
I think what's also lovely about this movie is the relationship between Autumn and her cousin, who goes with her, who really sacrifices a lot and risks a lot to go with her. She's the one who steals the money from the grocery store they both work at to fund the trip and the abortion. And they take off, and they have to, you know, they don't have anywhere to stay in New York. And so it's a pretty rough couple of days that they spend in New York. But she never seems to really flag or to not be supportive of her cousin. Even though there's very little spoken between the two of them.
I really wanted to, you know, make a film that's about, you know, how much women need women to get through these experiences. And even though, you know, they're so stigmatized and we're taught not to talk about them, that, you know, there's a fundamental sense of understanding from woman to woman about these experiences and how common they are.
Eliza Hittman is the director of the movie Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always, on demand now. You can rent it on digital platforms like Amazon or iTunes. Coming up, well, here to lift your spirits, drag queen Trixie Mattel. She is here in conversation and she's going to sing a song. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Maybe you've seen Trixie Mattel on RuPaul's Drag Race.
The champion of All Stars 3 is... Trixie Mattel.
There she is, being crowned the winner of RuPaul's Drag Race All-Stars Season 3. She's the queen that looks kind of like Dolly Parton, turned up to an 11. But Trixie Mattel is also a comedian, a television personality, and a singer. I spoke with her back in February, in person, if you can believe it, right before the release of her new album, Barbara. And the conversation begins with a little bit of music, so something for you to enjoy.
Jesse, Jesse, take my hand. You can meet me in zombie land. You know inside every clam's a pearl. I could be Jesse's girl.
Well, as you can hear, Trixie Mattel is with me now in the studio.
That's a good song.
Singing along, snapping along, in full drag, by the way.
Yeah, you are too. No one said anything. Yeah. She's in a yellow gown. She's wearing like this flame red updo with like finger waves on flat on the face.
You know, people would believe you.
Yeah, totally.
How would they know?
That's a great thing about going to do radio and drag. You don't have to really be in drag. You can just say you are.
Exactly.
But I really am today.
You really are. Yeah. I am attesting to that. You are in a 60s kind of what? Like,
well, I'm very into
flowers.
Yeah, it's like a floral print. I'm very into like head to toe pattern. Because it's a little fashionable, but it's also a little like, okay, no one would really wear that. So I like that line of like, you know, is it clown clothes? Is it fashion? It's like that middle part.
It's like, I'm actually doing the same thing wearing a jumpsuit.
Yeah.
Sort of similar.
It's a strong look. And I collect a lot of dolls. A lot of my dolls have these head to toe fabric looks and it's so weird and, you know, striking.
It makes it easier for, you know, when you get ready.
Yeah. It makes it pretty idiot proof. It makes it very like matchy matchy chic where it's like, it's meant to go together.
And you have white platforms on.
White platforms,
how many inches?
It's
I'd
like
say that's a good six.
Six if you measure it from the base.
Okay. So, yeah, you're a striking figure.
Yeah. Well, height is very powerful. Something. I mean, half the magic of drag is being tall, and people really believe you.
So when you're not in drag, how tall are you?
I'm just under 6 feet, just about 6 feet.
So you're tall anyway.
Yeah, yeah. I like being
And you're
tall.
Wearing a couple of wigs.
Yeah, a few
so that
wigs.
That adds the height.
Yeah, a few
Got
wigs.
Your beehive. Thing
yes.
happening.
The producer of the record, Nick, is in there and he's never even seen me in drag until today. And he was like,
what?
You're tall.
In person?
Yeah.
You
never seen me in person in drag. Because I didn't do the record. You know, spoiler alert, I was not in drag singing the record.
I guess
yeah.
you don't have to be in drag to sing on a record either.
No, you really don't.
That and the radio.
You can lie. I need to become the world's most famous like old-fashioned radio show drag queen. I've never actually dressed up.
Yeah.
Because
exactly.
the dressing up thing is...
It's a lot.
It's a
I
lot.
I appreciate the effort that you took to do
Thanks.
This.
Thanks. Thank
I really
you.
Do. So tell me about the album, because your last two records, Two Birds and One Stone, they were more folksy, singer-songwritery, country, that kind of music, roots music.
Sure.
Not a poppy, up, disco-y kind of sound. So,
well, I grew up listening to like country music at home, folk music. I grew up, you know, living with my grandparents. And so Two Birds and One Stone was definitely like a reflection of that. And, you know, Two Birds at the time, I broke up with a guy from Kentucky. So there was definitely a huge influence of that, too. Mm-hmm. It was a very bourbon-soaked, you know, cry yourself to sleep time of my life. But on Barbara, I'm a lot. It's a very upbeat record. you know, it's very California inspired. It's very perpetual summer.
Because you live here now.
Yeah, I've lived here for like 4 years. And so like this sort of like all year summer makes every day meaningful and meaningless at the same time, you know. And that's kind of what it's about. And Barbara, the name of the record was because, you know, if I grew up on country, but then, of course, I learned to play guitar to like power pop because like Blink-182, Avril Lavigne, I'm 30. So like that was my high school experience, was like that kind of music. Mm-hmm. So that's what I learned really songwriting on, was like imitating those kind of artists when I was young. So this record kind of feels like a natural progression to me, because that's the kind of music I still listen to a lot. You know,
you still listen to the music from your youth.
Totally. And I had like a...
I guess we all do.
We all do, right?
Do we just stop evolving when we get older?
You actually do. I think I read something that people kind of generally stop listening to new music at a certain point.
Yeah.
And it's fine.
And it's probably
before 30. I don't think I'm missing much. I really don't.
That's why
I don't watch award shows either. I'm
old
like,
people
who
say.
Are these people? Anyway, that's neither here nor there. But I guess with these records, I feel very fortunate because at the time after my last records, I had sort of like a second wind of like pop rock music. Mm-hmm. And I kind of deep dived back into some of my favorite records by like the Go-Go's and the Donnas and the B-52s.
Well, that's way before your time.
The Go-Go's? Yeah, but I love them.
And the B-52s.
Yeah, but I love them.
You're taking some style cues from them.
Totally.
Right?
I love the B-52s. I mean, they were basically doing drag without saying they were in drag.
Right.
Wigs. And I remember hearing interviews with them where they said they, as a band, would go to thrift stores and they would all fight over like the same dress, even though only two of them were women, you know. And I like that kind of attitude.
Yeah. Plus, their look is your look, right?
Yeah,
it's
totally.
Kind of up. Beehive, 60s.
Yes. And then I also collect Barbies from about 65 to 73. So that's kind of my sweet spot. So that's where a lot of my look influences come from.
Mm-hmm. Why is that time period your look?
I think to me, it's just the epitome of sort of like the fashion is just a jokier.
Yeah.
Like crazier prints. And it's also right when the body became more like, hide your boobs and your hips. Try to look like you have nothing. Everything is like a shift dress in A-line. Everything's meant to be like, look like
well,
a little.
You're not hiding yours. You're very curvy.
Well, this is nothing compared to, you know, like, there's like on the Malibu, some of the artwork from Malibu and from Barbara, I'm in like a tight little corset with huge hips. And this is like less curvy. This is my subtle look.
This is your day look?
Yeah, this is my day look. But I mean, we live in Los Angeles. I mean, I don't have more makeup or shaper on than anybody who's like a famous
musician.
You have
a lot of contour. That's...
Yeah, it's a heavy hand, but yeah. I also
am
a man, so I have to kind of like put in the extra, you know. Mm-hmm. But I mean, normal celebrities have on like double stack lashes and fake hair and
it's true.
A corset. It's like, where do we draw the line? I mean, it's all just fake hair and makeup and perfume, and it really all doesn't mean anything. I think drag queens, the reason they're so popular is because we're a constant reminder that it's like, if it's all dress up, you're all just putting clothes on.
Okay. You grew up in Milwaukee.
So I grew up in the deep, deep country, and then I went to college in Milwaukee.
And so deep, deep country meant what? Town
like
of how many?
Super far northeast Wisconsin, like dead end dirt road, no other kids for miles.
Wow.
Yeah. Like the first person to get on the school bus in the morning.
And so when did you get into drag?
Right away. No. when I went to college, I was in a production of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Uh-huh. And there was somebody who was sick. And so I had to jump into like a cross-dressing role. And it just sort of stuck. Like the name Trixie was the name of the character. That's part of where that even came from. I didn't even get the pleasure of picking a drag name. It was sort of thrust upon me.
And you didn't say no? You didn't change it? You thought, this is who I am. I'm Trixie Mattel.
Yeah, and it was sort of fateful because I had a really bad relationship with my stepdad, and he used to call me a Trixie whenever I was being too emotional or too feminine growing up.
What's a Trixie?
It was like saying, you're a fag or something. Uh-huh. You know, like you're a girly boy. And so that word used to really bum me out, and then now it's, you know, it's a brand and a lifestyle.
So when
I took back the night.
You took it back. So you did that on purpose. You were like, I'm going to take this back because this was so difficult for me. And
yeah.
I don't want this to be difficult anymore.
Yes. And I grew up really poor. And Trixie, I remember also looking it up on Urban Dictionary. And Trixie was a slang for like a rich white girl whose parents buy her everything. There's like another layer of like, oh, I'm into that too. So it was like the stepdad thing, the Rocky Horror thing, and this. It's sort of like Barbara. Barbara was Barbie's real name before she moved to California, right?
Yeah.
It also, the real etymology of it, it means strange woman.
Does it?
Yeah. And 12 years into doing drag, I'm a very strange woman. So that was sort of, there's a few reasons why that name for this record made sense.
But less stranger now because drag is so practically mainstream.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. I mean, it's sort of like how straight people gentrify neighborhoods. You know, they wait for gay people to move in and make it classy and then they move in.
Yeah.
Same thing happens with drag. Like, drag was always there. It just wasn't on television. So being on television obviously has made people a lot more aware of it. Because it's also, I think people are so afraid of sex that they think if there's cross-dressing, it has to be about sex. And so when you watch it on television, you're like, oh, never mind. It's just basically Halloween every day.
Right.
You know, it's Halloween meets stand-up, meets dancing, meets, it's pretty harmless.
It's not scary. I think people were scared of drag queens.
Totally. It's
because, well, A, there's the height. For one.
The height. My eye makeup, I mean, don't I look like one of those predatory moths?
A little bit.
The big eyes on their wings, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think it's really about sex because people are afraid of... I think people are so afraid of homosexuality that they're afraid cross-dressing means sex, which means tricking men into, like... It's all related to people's...
Well, why do so many straight guys dress up as women on Halloween or for parties or things like that, do you
it's
think?
A form of misogyny. Think about it. Their funny joke is that they might be anything like a woman.
Mm.
It's kind of dark. Do you also go as Asian for Halloween? Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know if dressing as a... But you know what, though? If it makes you feel good, if you're doing it for the right reasons, I guess the intention is the difference.
Yeah, because you wouldn't say that you're doing that.
If somebody to me was like, for Halloween, I'm going to wear a dress. Isn't that funny? I'd be like, yeah, that's so funny.
What if people said, I want to dress up as Trixie Mattel for Halloween?
They sure do. They really do. And on the tours... The first few rows, there'll be three or four or five people dressed as Trixie. And it's so weird to be performing and like see yourself sitting over there.
Do they get it right?
They try. I mean, it's a lot of technique. It's a lot of know-how that the average person shouldn't have. You know, I hope they invested their time and their education into something more usable.
Did you make it all up or did you also get tips?
No, I made it all up. I mean, I was doing drag for a few years before I turned 21. So like by the time I hit the clubs... I kind of have my own system in place, which is why I really look not like other drag queens. I think I just followed my own thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You're definitely not going for verisimilitude.
No, not at all. I mean, I never wanted to look like a woman as much as I wanted to look like a toy, like a plaything. You pull a string on the back, it talks. And then I figured out early on that I have this dark sense of humor and this thing about like, if it looks like a kid's toy, but... The comedy is sort of like more the anxieties of adulthood. That's a good match.
Yeah.
And anybody, that's the other great thing about drag is the message is sort of that anybody can be beautiful. It's really just creativity and money.
You're going to play a song, right?
Yeah, we would love to.
I'd love for you to play one.
Can we go now?
Yeah, play okay. Now. What's it called?
It's called Malibu. It's from my new record, Barbara. Okay. I wrote it about Malibu, someplace I've never been. If the song is about...
Wait, why have you never been to Malibu if you live here?
I got stuff going on. I got places to go. I got Postmates, you know?
Okay, this is Malibu by Trixie Mattel featuring guitarist Nick Goldston.
Been around for a long time now, I guess. Came around for a one-night thing and I never left. Got a key to your old front door. You can keep me in the bedside drawer. And when you want, you can slide me out again. Take your time. Everybody says so. You'll be fine when you learn to move slow. How did I lose you at the intro? Take me, I wanna go. Now, ooh, ooh, Malibu. Wanna go now, ooh, ooh, Malibu. I wanna go to me and you, Malibu.
That's Trixie Mattel, award-winning drag queen and singer-songwriter. Her new album, Barbara, is out now.
Never been with a type like you before.
out top down, just what I've been looking for.
Well, one day, hopefully soon, we'll all be able to go out to Malibu, hang out on the beach, go swimming in the ocean. That's coming. All right, stay safe, everyone. Stay indoors, stay home. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.
Take your time. Everybody says so. You'll be fine when you learn to move slow.